This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In this episode, we talk with Steve Hinton, president of the amazing Planes of Fame Air Museum. In the news, Delta Airlines signs a contract for sustainable aviation fuel. United Airlines decides to resume cargo-only flights. Qatar Airways profits were cut by COVID, while British Airways pilots have been offered an opportunity to fly with Qatar. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 673 of the show where we talk aviation. If you'd like to follow along with us, visit airplanegeeks.com/673 for the show notes. I'm Max Flight, and joining me first is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert.
Hello, everyone. Looking forward to tonight. Our guest plays with a lot of very, very cool toys. And I have to admit, I had a bit of a World War II weekend to also, but more of that later.
Okay, yeah, want to hear about that. Also with us is Brian Coleman, our former associate producer and co-host. And I don't know, Brian, you keep showing up so much lately that we may have to resurrect that title.
Or contributor, occasional contributor, roving reporter. I have no idea what my title should be these days. But yeah, I'm trying to do my part to contribute as much as possible.
Yes, and we have a lot of recordings from Brian that he made, some interviews that he recorded at the Cranky Dorkfest outside of LAX there. And I think we'll have those next week as the episode for the week. And there's some great stuff in there, some interesting people. You're going to want to watch for that one. Max Trescott, host of Aviation News Talk podcast, was out giving some flight instruction today. And he tells us that he was running late, so he is probably going to join us in progress. We'll see. And then finally, Rob Mark is off this week. So this is the crew. And our guest this episode is Steve Hinton, president of the Planes of Fame Air Museum. Steve, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
I think the last time you were on the show was about 3.5 years ago, I think, episode 495.
Yeah, and then 386 before that.
Before that. That was in 2016. So
you guys know more than I do, yeah.
Yeah, we keep going, you keep going, and that's great stuff. Now, I think previously we talked about the museum that it opened in 1957. And I think when we last talked about Planes of Fame, I think we said then that you had a collection of over 150 aircraft with two locations. Are those stats still appropriate?
Yes. Yeah, we're still here at Chino, and we also got a satellite museum in Grand Canyon at Valley Airport near the Grand Canyon. However, we've closed. It's not open to the public, you know, with the COVID and some of the other issues we've had there. The aircraft are still there, and they're still being taken care of. So.
Fantastic. Now, I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with Planes of Fame, but we'll have a few that maybe are not. But one of the interesting things to me about aviation museums is that they're all different. They have kind of a different feel to them, or they have different objectives. I like to think of them as having even different souls. What's the soul of the Planes of Fame Museum? How would you characterize that?
Well, it's a living history kind of collection of aircraft. You know, Ed Maloney started the museum back in the 50s and, you know, had the foresight to get anything he could find. And, you know, we ended up with some extremely rare airplanes that were just on the chopping block, basically. And it was also Ed's directive, or Ed's goal was always to, you know, if it's safe to fly these things, let's find a way to get them flying. So, you know, we have about 30 airplanes that are carry airworthiness certificates. And of those 30, we keep maybe 15 of them flying most of the year. And then some of the other ones we fly occasionally. Some of them we don't fly, but they're airworthy, could be flown. You know, there's just a lot of reasons for all this. You know, we kind of concentrate on displaying the airplanes and flying them for museum purposes. Take them to air shows, use them in movies, and honor our veterans and the story of technology and aviation.
That's one of the characteristics, I think, that differentiates some museums. Some are just static displays only. Others, like with you, fly some, many, or of the aircraft. And it's always kind of a, I don't know if it's a debate, but it's something worth talking about a little bit is, you know, should you not fly these things? Should they just be protected and stay indoors in pristine, restored condition? Or do you want to get them out there and fly them and show the public? How do you approach that issue in terms of, you know, flying or keeping it static?
Well, our philosophy is if we can do it safely, we'll do it. There are some airplanes that, we've got the only P-26 pea shooter, that flies. There's only two of them left. And it's an all-metal airplane built by Boeing in the 30s. And, we feel we could safely operate it. We have the world's only real Japanese Zero with a real Sakai engine. And that's the same thing. It's been restored to fly, and we fly it. We've got a lot of one-of-a-kind airplanes that are on display that aren't flyable as well. But it depends on the ability to safely operate it. And some airplanes are very important. We've been working on restoring a Bell P-59, which is America's first jet. And it could easily fly with a few months' work, but we have to get into a finish mode, so to speak, and it's been kind of down on our priority list just because of all the other projects we have going. But we will, just use that one as an example, we'll get that one going here hopefully in the next year or two. We'll see. But there's no real, written dogma on what we do. It's basically, if it can be done safely and if we can raise the interest and the funds to get it going, that's what we'll do. We use that analogy. It's like going to the zoo versus going to a wax museum.
Well, that's a good one. I like that.
Yeah, that's kind of the way we look at it. I mean, these things are living and breathing, and they walk in the hangar. You're going to smell oil and gas and coolant and elbow grease, and that's been our MO.
And Max, I think one of the other things, if I could jump in here, Steve, just to add to your comment about the museum, one of the things that I find most fascinating about it, and living here in Pasadena, I'm not so far away, so I get a chance to come over and participate with some of the events that you do. But to me, it's really that guest participation where you have the hangar talk events, you have the flying demo days, you really get the aircraft flying and you have a very large community show up to the museum on a regular basis and participate in the museum. And I think that separates you guys from other aviation museums as well.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, aside from that other subject of just why we fly them, that's what we do. Yeah. We have a living history day, we fly them, kind of, we'll pick an airplane and have a subject discussion about it. And our docents are here all the time to tell people about them. We use them in, like I mentioned, movies. We've used our planes in lots and lots of movies through the years. We just finished a movie called Devotion. We used the Bearcat and the Corsair in that. And that was, we filmed that up in Washington State. And then we went to Savannah, Georgia. So we were pretty busy with those airplanes. And it was a big production, and I think it's going to be it was a best-selling book made into a movie, and I think it'll be really a really good one because they really did, when I say they, the production company that is sponsored by Fred Smith from FedEx, they budgeted the money so we can really fly the planes and not do it CGI. It's a really great story. I think it'll bring a lot more interest into aviation again. As sometimes a movie comes out and everybody gets excited about history again. And I think this one will definitely do that.
Steve, how does the production company in a case like that get connected with you? Is that because they all know that you're the go-to guy, or how is that connection made?
Well, I've been doing this a long time, and that's part of it. You have your own network of people that you deal with all the time, or people know you through your reputation. And in this case, Fred Smith came to visit because we have a Corsair here, and he's just put up a FedEx operation just on Chino property, not on the airport, but anyway, a big operation. And we always have sent invites to him to come out and visit. So, and then coincidentally, he came out and showed him around. But that's a funny story, too, because I started to give him a tour, and it only lasted about 5 minutes. He took over.
Oh,
he
actually, right?
He actually gave a tour to the people that were with him, his daughters and some of the people that had been talking about this movie. And he took over and gave a tour, and he did a good job. I'd hire him in a minute as a docent. He's very, very knowledgeable on airplanes. He's got a great personality for that.
Who does the flying? Who pilots these planes in a production like that?
Well, I did, and then my boy did, and then my brother did. Kind of family thing, huh? Then we have a lot of our other guys. Rob Patterson has been with us for 25, 30 years. John Maloney, of course. John is a fabulous pilot. He's worked on a lot of movies. And then we used four other airplanes from different owners, and they participated with some of the flying as well. You know, I'm a member of the Screen Actors Guild, and I've been flying on movies since the Baba Black Sheep days back in their late 70s. So I've done a lot of things, and, you know, it's not tricky, but it's got to be done a certain way. You know, we have the expertise, and not just only in flying, but maintaining, and we have a network of people. We can help them locate airplanes, and that's how it kind of worked with this one.
Do you ever have to redirect the director who maybe wants the aircraft to do something that you're not really sure you want to do?
Well, redirecting a director is not the right term, but once in a while you do say no, yes. Once in a while it's, but of course, that's why they hire us too, is because you know, we have the experience, and rarely do you ever run into a conflict if you think something isn't safe. You know, we did that Pearl Harbor show and with Michael Bay, and he's known to be a shouter and a screamer. But we got along with him great. You know, he would ask and give you a funny look if you said no, but he respected it. So we didn't have any issues. I can't think of any time I really had a problem. Well, a couple of times, just to give you a silly story, because this is a geek show, right?
Yes, it is.
But remember that movie Forever Young with Mel Gibson? Remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a good movie, a great crew and all. Early in the, before we did any production, I went on a location scout to a Point Arena, which is it's the furthest western point of the United States. It's up north of San Francisco along the coast out there. And that was the area where they wanted to film that scene where he lands the B-25. And the discussion is, can you get a B-25 in here? I said, sure, there's enough room. You need to clear this field right here. And if you could drive your car on it at 80 miles an hour, give me, 2,000 foot of, and if you could drive it without chipping your teeth, then I would get the B-25 in there. So anyway, then off we go and start doing other parts of the show. And then the last thing is taking the B-25 up there. So we fly the B-25 up to Little River Airport I drove out to location to look at what they cleared. And yes, they cleared it, but you can't drive a car on it. I mean, it's so rough and bumpy. And it's like, so I'm the bad guy, They weren't listening, but I did refer to the letter I'd written them. So there's really no argument about it. But what saved us is we had done part of the show at Los Alamitos and that air show scene, if you kind of remember that. And the Marines were there, coincidentally, and anyway, they offered to put a landing mat down for us. So they put a big aluminum landing mat down, and that's what we landed on. So so the point I'm making, once in a while, there's a miscommunication or somehow. But we'll find a way to do it. If we could do it safely, we'll do it.
Sure. Well, you've mentioned docents. You've mentioned some folks that do some of the piloting. What other resources do you have at the museum to maintain, to restore, to do all the work of a museum?
Well, we're all volunteers. I'm the president of the museum. I'm a volunteer. I've been doing it since I was 7 years old, practically. So all our pilots work on the planes. We don't have just pilots, for instance. And we've got a very talented group of summer veterans, and some are very skilled mechanics, and some of them just want to be helpers. And that's how we get it done. You know, occasionally we have a budget where we hire people to do things, but the museum is, as you know, it's, as you can imagine anyway, when you take tickets and you do fundraisers to pay the bills, you know, we have a staff that run the museum and do the maintenance of the buildings and that operation. But it's hard to get a budget to, you know, how do you come up with, once in a while you do, but not very often. Most of it is from the love of working on them. And, you know, we'll find a way to do it, you know, through donations. And we have some supporters through the years that have helped us, as well as some big corporations have helped us with some projects as we go.
And Steve, at least before COVID, you also rented out the hangar space as well, right? For private events or parties, events like that?
Well, absolutely. The museum has a part of the hangar. Actually, the whole facility is available, but we have the Maloney hangar that we empty out and we use for rentals for weddings or any reason. We put on a hangar dances in the past. You know, we have our annual air show. We raise money with that and our monthly events that I mentioned earlier. It's you know, it's for the love of it, but it's also to make sure that we can, you know, keep the kitty serviced enough to where we have enough to maintain things. Hmm. And of course, there's never enough because our vision is really big. You know, if we would spend every penny plus that we had right now, if, you know, if someone made a huge donation, believe me, we'd find a way to use it, and it wouldn't be enough anyway. So there's a lot of airplanes that are still on the list, believe me.
Well, these are really, really difficult times for any organization that schedules events, and that applies to you as well. I mean, this year's air show, the 2021 air show, which was to be at the end of this month, October, you've had to cancel that.
Yeah, that was a big hit for us. You know, we put a lot of effort and a lot of rely on the income. It's our largest fundraiser for the year. But the prices are so inflated this year, you know, everything, the cost is up everywhere. Also, the uncertainty of the COVID restrictions. We can't afford to lose any money after having such a bad year and a half. You know, we were closed down for a long time and now we're opened. But we just made the choice, the decision. It was a tough one, but not to do the show. We just can't take the risk.
Yeah.
We would have had to raise the ticket price up too high. We felt it would be discouraging. It's hard to go from $25 to $45, you know, the next air show. So, you know, and then have to start charging for kids. So it just was, it was a tough decision. And we all scratched our heads on it quite a bit, but that we just felt that was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And it really is terrible because you guys are really one of the premier air shows in the world. And like, I'm always impressed every time I go, just seeing the quantity of aircraft in the air at any one moment. It truly is impressive what you guys do.
Well, I sure appreciate that. Thanks. So that's what we try to do, is put on a good show. And like I say, you can attest to that, how we'll start and we don't stop. We just keep going. And it's one thing after another. And you know, no one really gets paid to do the show. Either they come as volunteers and to help us raise money, and that's what's important. You know, I think you know, that's the way we've always operated.
David, do you have any favorite aircraft that one might find at the Planes of Fame Museum?
Well, I definitely like the P-26 is one of them. The last time we were on, Steve and I had a conversation about, unfortunately, what no longer exists was the N1M, the flying wing.
M9M.
M9M. So, it's been a long time since I've been out there, but the diversity that Planes of Fame has, I mean, it's a huge collection, 150 aircraft, but like what Steve said earlier, the P-59 that they want to restore to flight worthiness. I know of two P-59s besides theirs. Those kind of things are rare and really cool, and puts Planes of Fame in a different league than a lot of other places that do restoration.
Steve, earlier Brian mentioned a couple of kinds of events that you run, like the living history event and the the Hangar Talk event. Can you describe what those events are like, and are you holding those events now?
Yes, yeah. The for instance, the Hangar Talk event, something that's done every few weeks, and Brian will have a subject of an aircraft and an event, and you know, talk about it, and then we'll showcase an airplane. At least once a month, we try to fly an airplane. You know, since we went with this scenario over the since COVID anyway, we've flown the Mustang, the Avenger, the SPD,
the P-40,
yeah, the P-40, and the MiG. I think we did the MiG-15. I'm pretty sure we did it, but we've got you know, a lot of planes that it's a good subject and gives a good reason for people to, you know, to keep coming out. And you know, we have a lot of faithful supporters and members that come out, and it's P-38, for instance. We had the P-38. I think we had 1,500 people here on a Saturday, you know, and to watch it fly. And those are the kind of events that we're proud of, and we really want to continue doing it.
Are you able to attract young folks, children, you know, youngsters?
You'd be surprised, yes. I'd say less than we used to see, but there's still a lot of young people to come by, and a lot of them don't know what they're looking at, but they do appreciate it. I've had a lot of conversations with visitors that come in, and they'll ask questions, and they seem to be pretty interested in it. You know, here again, it's about the airplanes and about their story and about the, you know, what that meant to the you know, to where we are in the world today, you know, and it's pretty important. A lot of people don't, there's a lot of people that you talk to and they don't have a clue of like how many of these things were built, you know, yeah. Like when you tell them that you realize in the 5 years from 40 to 45, they built over 300,000 airplanes, you know, and they go, what are you talking about? You know, they have no clue of what this country was able to do when everybody's on the same page. And just think of all the ships and tanks. I know it's all military, and then you say warmonger stuff, but you know, it's not that. It's just that there was a reason everybody jumped in. Think of the technology boom. It's incredible.
Yeah, those were there's some decades there that just you know, you think will maybe never be repeated. I mean, we have our own you know, interesting things going on with aircraft development and aviation and so forth these days, but it's really a different kind of a thing. It feels like to me.
But anyway, another event that we hold, or we had a few times, so we had to delay it though again. So we have a Hangar Swing Dance. It's kind of a big hit. People dress up in the 40s and out they come, and that's usually packed. You know, and that goes into the evening, and that's got a lot of positive. We had people from all over the country come to that. You know, it's we had people knocking the door down practically. We had to limit it for the size of our hangar. So that's a pretty successful event.
Are you a dancer, Brian?
No, I'm not. But I wanted to go, and I believe 2 years ago when you had it, the ticket sold out, so I couldn't even get a ticket for the event.
Yeah,
So it's kind of upset over that.
Yeah, by law, we're limited by, you know, how many people we can, you know, safely operate with. So next time, let's get the ticket. Come on.
Yeah, I know. Buy the ticket early. Buy them early and often. No, and I heard that a lot of people dressed up in 1940s garb and, you know, really almost, went all out to participate.
Almost everybody did. I'm not kidding you. I would say that, you know, 99% of the people here, that's why they came.
Suits and the dresses on the women and the hairstyle and... Yeah. Yep. Yeah, lots and lots of fun. So, Steve, what other future events are you planning on doing at the museum? I know, again, it's a tough time and it's kind of hard with COVID, but you must have some other ideas kicking around.
Well, really, that's basically it. You know, Brian Finnegan, who runs our volunteers and runs the programs, has got a list of subjects for these events. And we feel out... as we go for these things, you know, what we think, if it can tie into any event or any veteran or anything in the news ahead of time. But, and also we try to relate to which airplanes that are going to be available. Some of them are scheduled to do other events, air shows, for example. That's basically it. You know, I mean, what I've laid out is really pretty, pretty busy, trying to keep things fresh and keep things, you know, interesting for people. So there isn't a lot I can say that we don't rule out, but it has to feel right before we'll do it. You know, I mean, it has to be something we feel that we can do, you know, a decent job at.
Yeah, I was wondering, for example, if you're planning on doing a pancake breakfast like they do at Spurwink.
Well,
right, Max,
we have,
you've been to that.
Yes.
Right?
Along those lines, we have we call the Kilroy Coffee Clash, and that's offer free coffee to veterans in the morning on, I believe it's the first Thursday of the month,
Tuesday.
Yeah, the first Tuesday of the month in the morning. And we've had 50 veterans come in for that. And that's just come in and shoot the breeze. And you know, then guys love it, though. If you guys got any ideas, let me know.
Yeah.
Well, personally, I'm taking notes and stealing ideas, but that's
okay.
Yeah, yeah. The American Helicopter Museum is going to start to look more and more like Planes of Fame, maybe, huh? David.
Yeah.
Hey, well, the coffee idea is brilliant. I'm going to have to bring that up since now I'm on exhibits team and events team. So, Steve, I might be stealing that from you.
Yeah, please do. Believe it or not, we stole it from somebody else. We have one of our friends up in Idaho, the Warhawk Air Museum. They came up with that idea, and we just pegged onto it. It's a fabulous idea. It gets, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, looking for some camaraderie for people with common experiences, and, you know, it's opened a lot of eyes up.
So, Steve, I've never been to one of those. I'm just imagining, though, that some of the veterans are quite interested in talking and telling their stories.
Yeah.
Or are they fairly quiet and reserved? Do they keep
well,
to themselves?
Well, it's all people. You know, some guys are come in their motorcycles and they got their bandanas on, and then there'll be the other guy in a business suit, you know. But there's been times, you know, everyone, it'd be a good crowd, or sometimes there's five guys. It depends on the weather. It depends on what's going on. But it's mainly just we're open arms here. You know, we welcome everybody. And there's a lot to see here. And there's a lot of ways people can connect.
Yeah, I'm going to have to come out for that.
Yeah, please do.
Earlier, Brian was talking about or hinting around some interesting flying that you've been doing lately, Steve.
Well, I do a lot of interesting flying.
I think so, but...
Yeah, and I pinch myself all the time. But lately, I've been for more than 20, maybe 25 years, I've been part of what's called the Heritage Program with the Air Force. And that's a program the Air Force had where they invited certain people to fly with current Air Force airplanes. So we do a profile, a display at air shows that's choreographed and it's called a heritage flight, and it follows the demonstration. So, for instance, like this weekend, I was at Huntington Beach out of John Wayne Airport. You know, the P-51 is where I based, and I flew with Bayo, her call sign. She, Christian Wolf is her name, and she's the Air Force F-35 demo pilot. We've flown together several times. We trained together out at Davis-Monthan. Once a year, our group gets together with the Air Force, and we train, you know, the Air Force has a new demo pilot every other year. In other words, they just do a 2-year span and then they switch on to somebody else. And so we'll train in March at Davis-Monthan. And then the schedule comes out and we fill in the blanks and we participate where we can with different airplanes. I've flown the Mustang or the F-86 or the P-40 or P-38. Or P-47 with the Air Force airplanes that are have demoed airplanes, F-35, F-22, F-16, and A-10. Those are the four airplanes currently as demonstration airplanes. So we'll, for instance, my part of it is I will be orbiting behind the crowd while the F-35 goes through its maneuvers, which is pretty impressive if you're a pilot and you got to see it from my seat. how fast that thing goes and how high it goes and how many G's it pulls, for instance. It's not King Kong, by the way. The F-22 is the one that's really the most impressive thing that I've ever seen. But anyway, once we're done with that aerobatic demonstration, then I enter the scene and the F-35 jumps on my wing. And then we do a orchestrated display of some passes. We'll show the tops of the airplanes with a banana pass. We show the belly of the plane with a turnaround. We fly right over the top of the crowd. And then we split and do a couple rolls, and then we'll do individual passes. And that's called the heritage profile. And it's the same with all the different airplanes I told you about. The difference is some airplanes are more compatible than others. For, you know, the F-22 or the P-40 or the Thunderbolt is not very exciting. Well, it's really exciting, actually, but it's not, the airplanes are so different, obviously. Propeller airplanes and jets are so different anyway, especially the modern jets, because they're fly-by-wire and they're, you know, the current aerodynamics, you know, the way the airplanes go through the air, it's pretty impressive. But the F-86 is my favorite because you can get it going 400 or 500 miles an hour to do that profile. And those young demo pilots over there, it opens their eyes because this 1950s jet can keep them on their toes. So it's fun to do.
Yeah, I'd imagine it's a little bit easier to keep up as well. Right. In the Mustang, you're probably flying as fast as you possibly can. And the F-35's going as slow as it possibly can.
Well, we don't fly the Mustang, we don't push these airplanes at all. So I prefer it when I'm flying a Warbird to lead, just because I don't like to, you know, the airplanes are so different because angles of attack, you know, like in a steady state, you can fly real close, good formation without adjusting much power. But as soon as you poke it downhill, for instance, you know, the airplanes are so different. You wouldn't believe it. Like an F-16, for instance, when you're going downhill, they pull the power way back, of course. No, I'm sorry. They have to add power going downhill, believe it or not, because it's all about angle of attack. Just a little bit of power when they're on your wing. And as they climb up, they actually pull the power back a little bit. It's doesn't make a lot of sense. But we do have to demonstrate that at our training scenario where we'll fly on their wing and they fly on our wing back and forth just so they can see how different it's from outer space difference is what I'm saying between the two airplanes, the way they go. It's crazy.
I was going to ask you about the practice in advance of a heritage flight. How much practice takes place?
Well, like I say, we get together. There's eight of us, eight being eight civilians, and then the demo teams. And we'll fly for 3 days a day. We'll train in a classroom setting, so to speak. And then we fly two or three sorties a day for 3 days with all the different airplanes and all the different pilots to introduce ourselves to each other and then introduce them to their, you know, these warbirds, so to speak. So
you're training or practicing for the entire season. Is that right? You're not practicing for a particular event.
Once you're on the road, you know, then you're just going to get better and better and better. And then by the end of the display, you're, you know, usually the very last show you do is pretty good. Usually
you figured it out by then.
Yeah. For instance, at Reno, I had the Mustang with the F-35, and on the Saturday, it was 30 knots of wind, and it was blowing like crazy, obviously, and really rough and bumpy. And that was a real trying thing to do, especially, you know, the wind picks up. It was kind of blowing, but then I'm airborne, and now it's really howling. So you do the display, and I'm thinking, okay, which runway can I land on now? Because there's everywhere's a crosswind. And fortunately, it was in the Mustang, because a Mustang is easy to handle in a crosswind versus a P-40 or a P-47 or something like that. It had been more of a handful involved there. So, but every day's got a story.
So next week, are you going to be up in San Francisco for Fleet Week up there?
Well, we had planned to be there, but the air show had a change of schedule, so they canceled the F-16 and Heritage flight. Yeah. So my next one will be in Tucson, which is in November. And because I'm an old guy, that'll be my last Heritage flight too. So,
really?
Yeah.
You're going to retire from?
Well, I've been on waivers for the last 4 years because at 65 is when you're supposed to retire, but I managed to win the card game all the time and they let me extend it. So, but they can't have a 70-year-old guy doing Heritage flight. So it's perception is what it is. It has nothing to do with, I'm not the only one because Frank Borman had to retire. Bill Anders had to retire. General Ursler had to retire. Lee Lauterbach had to retire. But they told me I had to retire. And I said, hey, can I put in for a waiver? And they all looked at each other and they go, oh, yeah, maybe that'll work. So those other guys didn't think about that, but I did.
Yeah. So are you going to have your son pick up for you?
Well, he's been invited and he's very busy. I hope he is able to do it. He'd be exceptionally good at it, and he'd be a good representation for the Air Force. He's running a business, though, and he's got a brand-new son. So
congratulations,
I'm sure he'll find time to do some of them. So I hope he does.
So you're a grandpa now.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. Those are different heartstrings, too, as a good friend of mine told me that before it happened. He said, you'd be surprised.
Yeah.
And I was, yeah.
For sure. Yeah, and you get to give them back at the end of the day, too.
Best part.
Well, that's not the best part. This kid is pretty awesome, pretty special, of course.
Yeah.
They all are, but I'm just saying, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's different than having your own kids, though. So, because Steve's a twin, His twin sister, Amanda, and she's in the Air Force. She's a captain and she's a doctor in the Air Force.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah.
You must be a proud papa.
Absolutely. She works her tail off. And I'll tell you another stupid little geek story is when they're little kids crawling around on the ground, twins, right? Hmm. Steve-O's looking in the sky all the time and he's, looking at airplanes and talking airplanes, and Amanda's chasing bugs and playing with dolls. Which one of them is in the Air Force? I'd have lost that bet, right?
Yeah, you never know.
You never know.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, really proud of both of them, though. They both worked really hard for where they are in their life, and they just got a long way to go.
Steve, anything that we can look forward to at the museum coming up in the next year or so? Any big projects or things of interest?
Well, on a side note that I've been, I have a company that is called Fighter Rebuilders, and that we have our own lease on the airport, but it's at the museum. And that's part of our museum MO too, is we have a restoration shop that's full time. It's just on the museum property. And that allows, you go to some museums and you visit them twice, they're the same thing. You visit them three times, the same thing. But because we have this other business on the facility, it provides, there's always something going on. So, we're rebuilding airplanes. We've done 40 airplanes since 1980, Warbirds.
And Steve, so actually you stole my last question because I was going to ask about that. And I think we could probably do an entire show on your Rebuilders company, but I think that it's so great on the Saturday events where you open up the hangar doors as well and people could look inside and see the aircraft that you're working on. So
mess.
Just fantastic for doing that. And I hope you continue to do that because it's so inspirational.
That's Steve's livelihood. That's how like say that we're volunteers at the museum, but that allows us to volunteer time at the museum because we have to earn a living somewhere. And but where I was going with this, too, is we're finishing up. You say what projects are out there. The museum acquired Lockheed Constellation back in 1992. It was General MacArthur's Constellation. And through the help from our volunteers as well as Lockheed, we were able to it was in the NASA configuration because after MacArthur was done with it, it was converted and used by NASA as an airplane to help set up the tracking for the Apollo project. So when we got it, it was painted NASA. And then through Lockheed, like I mentioned, they repainted it for us in MacArthur's markings. And then they put an interior in it, a replica of what MacArthur had. And we had the thing for 20 years. We flew it a little bit, but we realized we could either keep that flying or we could keep 15 of our other airplanes flying. It's that, because it's a big airplane. I mean, it's a pretty complicated airplane by our standards. But anyway, we took it out to Arizona, and it was part of the display out there. It's a good place to keep airplanes. It's dry weather, and it preserved it pretty good. And then one of our friends got interested in it, and he has the ability to restore it. He can maintain it, a fellow named Rod Lewis. We made a deal with him, and for the last 6 years, we've been restoring it. So the next time you see that thing, it's going to be like brand new. We've gone through the whole thing. And it's a beauty. It doesn't, you know, it's not painted yet or anything, and the interior's not in it, but the systems and engines and landing gear and all the, you know, all the mechanical things on it are like brand new on it. So I'd say another year and a half, by the time it gets out of the paint shop, and when you see it in magazines, you're going to say, oh, that's what he was talking about. But it's a pretty special airplane, you know, because it was a historical airplane. You can look online and find pictures of it with MacArthur and Eisenhower in it, and different, the history behind it is special. And I always joke with everybody too, you can't even work on it with a 6 foot ladder. You got to have a 12 foot ladder. it's a big airplane.
Connie, yeah. Sit up high.
Yeah. Big time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my favorite airplanes of all time.
Well, you need to come out and look at it. I will. Pretty awesome. Yeah.
I will, for sure.
Please do. Please
and Bataan do. Has quite the history.
Yes, it really does.
Well, Steve, where can our listeners learn more about the museum?
Well, we have a planesoffame.org website, and I would say keep on that. Our Brian Finnegan keeps that all up to date. There's usually become a member, get on our mail list. You know, we've always got things happening, information, events. Aviation news. We accept donations, believe me, that really helps. It'll be put to good cause, I promise. We have a lot of our volunteers come out on Saturdays mainly, some during the week as well. We have a docent program here too, so anytime you visit, there's always a smiling face. A lot of them are veterans and very knowledgeable. They can answer a lot of questions, and then you can see fighter rebuilders working on different planes here as well. So,
sounds very exciting, Steve. We want to thank you for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Well, it's, you know, like I say, I've been here since I was seven.
Yeah.
And of course, I do other things as well. But I mean, it keeps my blood pressure up all the time, and in a good way.
There we go.
Hey, look at that.
Brian's so holding up.
Look at that member.
Card. Yeah.
I'm going to check that number and see if you're faking it.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. Thanks.
The sticker on the back is still valid, right?
He's current.
There he goes.
So, yep.
See? Brian, you're one of my favorite guys right now. Thank you.
Yeah.
You got my money for a family membership at that, too.
Yay!
Very good.
Even better.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate you guys inviting me on the show, and please spread the word. You know, our airplanes are bringing a lot of people together.
Yes.
You know, we all dream. When little kids dream about flying before they ever got wings, and you know, it's just part of the human spirit, I think. So here we are.
Is that Brian who's in the office with you?
Yes, he is.
Maybe we should get him on the show. So, is he as interesting to talk to as you?
He's way more interesting than I am.
Maybe we'll have him on someday.
No. So thanks, guys.
Thanks,
good
Steve.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Frank.
You're welcome. Okay, Brian, bye.
He's gone.
Hello.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
I'm good.
Thanks for helping facilitate our conversation with Steve. We appreciate it.
No, it was my pleasure. Yeah. You know, he's a fascinating guy. And for all his success and all his notoriety, he is perhaps the most level-headed guy you'll ever meet. And he is a joy to work alongside. And, you know, this museum is under his stewardship has really grown leaps and bounds. I was fortunate to also get to know Ed Maloney, who founded the museum. And Ed was an amazing person. Even into his latter years, you could ask him any question about any aircraft, and within seconds, the recall was absolutely astounding. He could look at a photograph from World War I and tell you what that aircraft was. And So this is an organization that really does attract some pretty remarkable people.
Yeah, and I think as the founder, he kind of set the tone for what the museum was and would become. And it really feels like that's been carried forward.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. You know, the whole story of Ed Maloney and this airport are so deeply connected. So Chino Airport doesn't exist in any way, shape, or form prior to 1940. And it's agricultural fields. And there is a movement in 1939 when the storm of war is brewing. It hasn't yet erupted in Europe. And you've got Japan and China at odds in the Pacific. And the United States begins to look at itself and say, you know, are we ready? Should we get pulled into any of these potential conflicts? And what they found out was no. And in particular, the Army Air Force looked at it and they said, first of all, we don't have enough planes. And Roosevelt takes care of that. It's beginning in 39 and then 40 by enlisting, you know, Congress to build more planes. But they couldn't train pilots. Their capability was about 500 pilots a year. And it was an 18-month program at best. And so under Hep Arnold's direction, he enlists 8 civilian contractors to build contract schools to begin primary training. And one of those guys is a name, Corliss Champion Mosley, or C.C. Mosley, a former Air Corps person from World War One who had been involved with the Army for years and then went into private ventures. And he starts a school as one of these contract schools to provide primary training in Glendale. And they have to have at least 2 auxiliary fields. He builds one in El Monte, it's actually El Monte Airport, and then he builds one in Chatsworth. And right away he runs into problems in the Chatsworth facility that the 2,000 people who live there don't mind having these steermans flying overhead, but over 10,000 workers who work in the area refuse to do their jobs, and their employers complain loudly, and it goes through the local government all the way back up to the Army, and they say, you're going to have to find a new location. Those workers were 10,000 chickens who refused to lay their eggs because of the noise of the biplanes overhead. Oh. So Mosley moves his facility to nearby Reseda, and it's 1939, and they're flying in and out of Reseda, and next to Reseda is Encino, which is home to the RKO Pictures movie ranch, which at the time they are filming The Hunchback of Notre Dame, starring Charles Laughton. Steermans are flying into the shot of Quasimodo being whipped in the Paris Square. The noise is even breaking through the sound stages, and again, they complain. And the Army tells Mosley, you got to find a whole new location because Glendale's too crowded anyway. And so he looks around and he finds this area here, and he builds a base called the Cal Aero Flight Academy, which from 1940 to 1944 graduates over 10,000 pilots. And some of them went on to quite distinction, including a Medal of Honor recipient. In 44, it's closed, and then they use the facility as a staging area for obsolete aircraft. And over 2,600 aircraft are brought here. They try to sell them. They're not really successful. And the next thing you know, they're chopping them up and melting them down for the aluminum and the other metals. And there's this young kid who lives in Pomona, 18, and he comes over and he watches this. And at one point he sees a stack of manuals. He described it as 2 stories tall. And he said, what are you going to do with those? And they said, we're just going to burn them. And he says, can I have them? And they said, kid, you can have whatever you can take. And it transforms his life. He decides that this is wrong, and he sets a personal goal that will last the rest of his life, and that is to save and preserve as many aircraft as he possibly can. And with very low income means at the time, he manages to begin. And by 10 years later, by 1957, he has 10 aircraft, and he opens a museum in Claremont. And lo and behold, that's the beginnings of the Planes of Fame Air Museum. And over Ed's life, he will save 250 aircraft. Some of them are in the Smithsonian, the Air Force Museum, the Navy Museum, and other museums around the world. So he was an amazing man who literally committed his whole life to the preservation of aviation history by maintaining aircraft. So that story and this airport are linked in that regard. And so that's why Chino is such an amazing home for us at this point.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah,
absolutely amazing.
Yeah. When you have one person who has that, I don't know, that vision or that drive or that passion that just cannot be stopped. And it just amazes me how, as a result of that, we all benefit to such a huge degree just because of the origins of this one individual.
And yeah. And Max, it really extends beyond just Ed. I believe it was 2, maybe 3 years ago, I attended the air show and had an issue with the media pass. And I ran across, I didn't know it at the time at first meeting, but I came across his granddaughter who was volunteering working there. And she was just so incredibly sweet and nice and helpful getting my credentials sorted out. And you know, I asked her what she was doing at the airport and why she volunteered. And then she finally told me, you know, who she was. Mm-hmm. And again, just the spirit of wanting to give back and contribute and be a part of the museum and being so proud of what her grandfather did. It was just great.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, Brian, thanks for stepping in. That was, you're kind of our surprise second guest for the episode. Maybe you had it planned that way all the time, but so we got Steve and Brian. So
well, I was happy to step in. I hope the story wasn't too long.
Oh no, it was perfect.
Yeah, it was perfect. It was very good. On to the news. Our first item comes from environmentalleader.com. This is Delta purchases more than $1 billion worth of sustainable aviation fuel, also known as SAF. I wonder if they call that SAF. But what we have here is Delta Airlines has signed an agreement with Aemetis for SAF, for sustainable aviation fuel. It's a 10-year contract worth more than $1 billion. And in the Aemetis press release, they say for 250 million gallons of blended fuel containing sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF, to be delivered over a 10-year term of the agreement. And that's valued or estimated to be more than $1 billion. This fuel is going to be produced pretty close to you, Brian, right? In Riverbank, California. How close is that to you?
I actually don't know where Riverbank is. Oh, okay. So
well, it's all California.
Probably next to a river.
Yeah, maybe.
Perhaps.
Go to quick Google Maps to see about that. So must not be too close if I don't know where it is.
they're building this. Here's a clue. They're building this on a 125-acre site, a former U.S. Army ammunition production plant site. But their technology, they're kind of centered around creating this fuel from waste forest and orchard wood. So there is no crop, I guess, no crops or something that would otherwise be foodstuffs being used here. And this plant's going to produce 90 million gallons per year. Expect this fuel to be available in 2024. So pretty good.
And Riverbank's out by Modesto, which literally is in the middle of nowhere, California. So
okay, good.
Now I guess I understand why they were doing munitions out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting. It's Delta. Delta was the one that purchased the fuel refinery, too.
Yeah.
They're constantly thinking ahead as far as fuel goes.
Yeah, but I heard a story here on the news where they were talking about biofuel being less than 3% of the fuel that's consumed. So yes. Although this is a really large contract, it certainly isn't much as far as what's burned every year.
On a percentage basis. In fact, I tried to poke around at that. I mean, what I really wanted to answer was the question, what percentage of Delta's annual jet fuel consumption would this represent? And I found something called Business Quant, and they have a piece, Delta Airlines Fuel Consumed 2016 to 2021. And I don't know anything about Business Quant or their methodology for arriving at this data, but they said owing to Delta's massive fleet and the number of flights per day, the airline uses about 3.4 billion gallons of fuel every year. So if we're talking about 250 million gallons as a result of this contract signed over 10 years, it's still a really, really small percentage.
Ah, but you can say you're doing something.
Yeah, that's true. And it's a start. So not to, you know, not to minimize the accomplishment here, but to be truly meaningful, yeah, it's becoming clear that these kinds of things need to be scaled way, way, way up. Another item. This is from Paddle Your Own Canoe. This is from Trescott, who, you know, he never showed up. Max Trescott never showed up. We'll have to give him a hard time. But, yeah, I guess, was it he who had a Paddle Your Own Canoe article a couple of weeks ago? This is United is restarting cargo-only flights because the Delta variant is having such a big impact on bookings.
Yeah, he put this one in for me because I'm not flying nearly as much as I used to. So United's feeling the pain.
Yeah. So, well, they had, you know, been operating some cargo only flights when the passenger bookings took a, you know, fell off a cliff. But they have gotten away from that, the cargo only flights, because of increased bookings, but because of the Delta variant, apparently it's going back down again, and so United is set to resume cargo-only flights using empty passenger planes. As the article describes, passenger planes can be used for freight in different ways. One is just fill up the cargo hold, send the plane on its way with no passengers, or in some cases, airlines have been carrying freight in the passenger cabin, sometimes just strapping boxes to seats. Others have removed the seats to make for more room. So airlines are, you know, dealing with this in different ways. I'm wondering if this, you know, sort of on again, off again, is it a passenger plane? Is it a cargo plane? I wonder if this is going to lead to some long-term changes. I don't know. I'm thinking about airlines.
Combis.
What's that?
Yeah. There's going to be a bunch of combis. I mean, Alaska Air flew combis a long time.
Yeah.
The back of the airplane was passengers and the front of the airplane was cargo.
Yeah, the 737-700s. Yeah.
So I wonder if airlines are going to, you know, plan for more flexibility in terms of how they utilize their aircraft when these kinds of things are happening. Or I wonder if they're, you know, getting back to the combi thing, I wonder if this will lead to design changes from the airframers that will make it easier for an operator to switch between cargo and passengers.
Put in a much larger rear door by the galley.
Yeah,
so they
like
could
that.
Get the containers in and out.
Right, to offer the flexibility, because it would seem like, well, things like that.
You just make it a gaping hole and you just put cargo netting seats along the sides of the fuselage, a la every military air force on the world. Yeah. It would work. You know, there are certain people, like, I won't say a certain Irishman, who Mr. O'Leary, who wouldn't mind having an airplane that he could just have cargo seats and for his passengers. So.
And some of the slimline seats are equally as comfortable as those canvas netted seats.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so the implications, I don't know. I'm excited to see what might come of this, or maybe just things go back to the way they were.
I think for the long term, I think cargo is going to be more of a moneymaker than it is than passengers. I mean, and what we thought was a recovery earlier this year is really not a recovery. And, you know, with thousands of ships stuck off of the coast of Los Angeles with all of my product for my store, mm-hmm. They're going to have to, I mean, there's people waiting for stuff and all of these shortages, et cetera. Airplanes are going to be a huge factor. So I think airlines are seriously going to consider, you know, I mean, if FedEx, Amazon, and UPS can't keep up with the loads, you know, the airlines, they got airplanes and they've got pilots. So, I mean, why not strip them of the seats and fly them?
Right, right. All right, Micah sent in a story. British Airways Boeing 777 pilots will go on secondment to Qatar Airways over the winter. And, whoa. This is also from Paddle Your Canoe. Oh, paddleyourowncanoe.com. What is going on here?
They're in the aviation news business now.
I guess so. Or is it just that, you know, Micah and Max Trescott, they're messing
have
with us.
Have subscriptions.
Yeah. Have subscriptions. So this is what you see. Well, there's a seasonality to flights out of London. Typically during the winter season, there are fewer flights. So one issue would be, what do you do with all the pilots? But according to an internal British Airways memo, up to 40 Boeing 777 captains and first officers have an opportunity to go fly planes with Qatar for around 6 months. Now, I guess according to this memo, pilots would temporarily relocate to Doha. Their current contracts and seniority with BA would be maintained, and they would continue to be paid by British Airways. But it's not a done deal, I guess. It says discussions between these two airlines still in early stage. And BA says that there are, quote, significant complexities involved.
I don't ever remember hearing something like this ever before. In the years that I've been doing the podcast, and that's the only time I ever cared about airlines was since I've been doing this podcast. So,
but David, do you still care?
Yeah, I have a vested interest in it. But okay, that being said, this is different. I mean, shipping off your pilots off to somebody else's pilots is off to somebody else's airline is kind of interesting.
Hey, I think for the right person, if you have the right lifestyle, I think this is a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah, so do I. This would be very exciting, I think. Yeah, for the right kind of person who's able to do this. Now, to David's point, I mean, there is a relationship between Qatar Airways and BA. Qatar owns or has a 35% stake in the parent company of BA. So that there is that kind of, you know, intersection of the companies. One thing that's brought out in the article is it's not clear how much training the pilots would need, and not from the standpoint of learning the aircraft, because we're talking about the same aircraft here, I think, but just the different Qatar Airways policies and procedures. Also, they'd be flying to different destinations potentially than they were used to. So that's one of the complexities of all that. But there's other Qatar news. It's an AP story, and the headline is Qatar Airways says losses reach $4.1 billion amid pandemic. But when you read in the article, those aren't their losses. That's the amount of reduction in profit that they attribute to COVID and all. So despite that big drop, Qatar reported an increase in earnings to $1.6 billion before taxes and other costs. This was compared to the previous year. But Qatar has been doing some things to cut costs, as I think all the airlines have. They've saved a lot of money on jet fuel just because they haven't been flying. They reduced salaries by 15%. And they also reduced the workforce by some 13,400 employees. So all that will have a big effect on, you know, the cost structure of an airline.
Well, I think that was interesting with Qatar as well. It's not mentioned in either of these articles, is they, of course, pulled all of their A380 service.
Right.
If people aren't flying around, why fly around such a large plane? But because the A350, they had so many of them grounded, I believe, for maintenance issues, they've actually reintroduced the A380 back into service to pick up the demand for the A350. So I think that it's nice that they have a large aircraft or another wide body that can take over some of that load. But I think the cost per mile for the A380 is significantly larger. So this has to be hitting their bottom line.
Mm, yeah, yes. There's another change, and you may not be aware of it, but Qatar Airways had been under a political embargo. There's disagreements over things, I guess, in that region, and we won't go into those. But Qatar Airways had been locked out of the airspace of Bahrain, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and UAE, United Arab Emirates. And so as a result of that embargo, Qatar had to take longer routes around those airspaces, which consume more jet fuel, increase expenses, and so forth. But I guess we see that the embargo has somehow been resolved or something, and so that will help Qatar a lot. Maybe the increased flying that they hope to do as a result of all this is maybe why they're interested in some pilots coming over from BA.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
And then finally, I don't know, you might have seen, I saw in the news about some kind of oil spill off the coast of California. And there are, images of crews out trying to contain the oil spill and waterfowl that have been soaked in oil and dead fish and so forth. But, Brian, this turns out to be a local story for you.
Yeah, it certainly is. And it's where the air show was over the weekend. So at Huntington Beach, they actually canceled the last day of the air show because the oil was washing up on shore. So I think they've said that between 126,000 gallons and 130,000 gallons were spilled before they were able to turn off the pipeline and drain it. But that's still a tremendous amount of oil that was released into the ocean. Before we started recording, I heard that the oil slick got to 30 miles in size, so affecting quite a bit of waterway. And it's certainly on the local news, the images of the beach at Huntington Beach. So they were showing where the pavilion was, where the center flight line was, just how the beach there is closed. And you could see from high tide to low tide where the oil was up on the sand and quite a bit down the shore, because we have a water flow that goes from north to south. It's gone into La Jolla, which is really in San Diego County. So it's gone across an entire county. So I think, yeah, the environmental impact of this is going to be around for quite some time.
So am I correct? They got one day of the air show accomplished?
Actually, 2 days. So the air show was Friday. And yeah, so they did practice on Thursday, then Friday, Saturday were the air show, and then they canceled on Sunday. Which I thought at first, it's like, why are they canceling it? Because people are going to be on the beach. Nothing's really happening in the water. You could get away from it. But when you saw how much oil washed up on shore and the smell of the oil as well, it's just not a good place for people to be.
Yeah.
Either walking through the oil or breathing the fumes. So.
Oh, come on. You have an aircraft come down with its afterburner. Just think about the wall of fire that would be on the...
Light it up, huh? Yeah, yeah. I don't know. This is probably the first time an air show has been cut short as a result of a oil pipeline rupture in the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's various speculation on what caused it, and I certainly know from airplane accidents and incidents not to speculate, so I'm not going to say anything more about that. Hopefully over the next few days we'll find out more and actually have some fact to talk about.
But in simplest terms though, Brian, we should state that this is a pipeline that's running from an offshore rig onto the coast. That area of California has a lot of pipelines coming from offshore inland for processing. This is not a common thing. It's these kind of pipelines are up and down the coast in California, where a lot of people who are overseas listeners or people on this side of the country might not realize that why was there a pipeline that got broke? So,
It's really a miniature oil basin. I believe, if I get this right, they used to refer to Los Angeles. So this was back in the teens and before, as Little Kuwait, because there was so much oil and so many derricks in the Long Beach, Signal Hill area. The mainland was just loaded with oil production. And then when they started doing the offshore exploration, the things that people might be familiar with in the derricks that are either in the Gulf or the North Sea, there are a bunch of them from Santa Barbara all the way down to here in Orange County. They're dozens, if not hundreds, of them offshore.
Okay, before this turns into hydrocarbon geeks, what's up with the airplane geeks? David, how's things at the museum?
It's October, and I've got four more weeks before I die of exhaustion. But our first event occurred over the weekend. I'm actually kind of proud of this. I officially have a title change besides retail manager that I'm also exhibits coordinator. And the first exhibit that I co-helped build was our exhibit that we're running through December 2nd, which is a history of the Tuskegee Airmen. There's a book called The Tuskegee in Philadelphia, Rising to the Challenge, which is a book that was written by a professor in Westchester University, who's right by us, about the Philadelphia participants. And Philadelphia, besides Chicago, were the two largest cities that contributed to what became the Tuskegee Airmen and the Tuskegee Experiment. And I was fortunate enough to have my exhibit visited on Saturday by five of our Tuskegee Airmen that are still in the Philadelphia area. One is over 100 years old and sharp as a tack. They are a great bunch of guys, very gracious, and you love hearing their stories. So I put a couple of photographs in. So that we're running till December 2nd, at which point I have to start working on the next project, which will be 2022's project, which is the history of helicopters and the presidents, because we're going to be celebrating the 65th anniversary of Eisenhower's first flight in a Bell H-13. So, but that's more to come. But we've got more things happening. We've got a STEM weekend coming up this weekend. And then the weekend afterwards, we got the debut of our newest aircraft, which is the Gander Express. But we'll talk more about that next week.
All right. Nothing for you, Brian, right? Nothing additional?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't been flying much. I might get one more trip into Florida around the first of the year. But unfortunately, no, air travel's really been limited to me. But I did attend the Huntington Beach Air Show this past weekend. And I know we've run a little bit long, but I certainly wanted to talk a little bit about some of the acts that were there. So don't know if should do that now or wait for another show.
Can we wait for another show?
Sure.
Because I'm like dying here.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay.
So with that, we're going to wrap it up. Max is in a car, locked up and unable to breathe. So we're going to call this show done. What do you think, Max?
I think we should. Thanks everyone for listening. We want to thank Steve Hinton for joining us from the Plains of Fame Air Museum, where he's the president, and also our kind of surprise bonus guest, Brian Finnegan, who stepped in after Steve. And you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Email thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And I will ask all of you to please join us again next week. Please join us again.
Weeks.
Yeah, all of us in 2 weeks. But Brian and Dorkfest interviews, which include a surprise guest, you're going to want to listen to this next week. So tune in, and bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
Bye, everybody.
And thanks for listening.